Well, thank you for the birthday wishes. My sons really encouraged me. They said, Dad, please tell us again what it was like when the dinosaurs roamed the earth. So, that was a little extreme, but I was having a conversation with Pastor Josh Swanson. He says, Hugh, how long have you been teaching this paradoxes class? I said, well, since 1974. He says, oh, that's when I was born. So, yeah. But hey, I'm grateful for all the years God has given me, and I'm really looking forward to continuing to serve Him. And hey, I figure as long as I can enjoy mountaineering, I'm going to keep leading this class and doing what I can to serve the Lord. One thing, we had Ken Wolgamuth here in the class, a research geologist that was with our Reasons Scholar Program for a while. And he wanted me to make available to you a little gift that he had, which is basically a little card which gives you the geological time scale. So if you ever wondered, okay, where exactly is the Carbonaceous era, this will tell you. You'll have it right there at your fingerprints. So whenever you run into somebody that's younger than 30 and they start talking about all these geological years, you'll be all equipped. So maybe I can, there we go, get that. Okay, thank you. So what I did in my birthday is actually do a whole bunch of radio interviews. That's a great way to celebrate your birthday. But the reason I was doing so many, and I don't know how many I've done actually, is because of the lunar eclipse that took place on Friday night. A lunar eclipse that was seen by more human beings than any lunar eclipse in the history of humanity. So how many of you got to see the eclipse? Okay. You must have seen it through some kind of media, because everybody on planet Earth is able to see it, except for people living in North America. 7 billion people got to watch it, but nobody in North America got to see it. So, and the reason why so many people got to see it, it's unusual in that the moon passed very close to the center of the shadow of the Earth. And of course, that makes for a longer eclipse. And the other reason is that the moon was farthest away from the Earth in its orbit. Its orbit is slightly elliptical, and because of its distance and its passing close to the center, this works out to be the longest lunar eclipse in the 21st century, an hour and 43 minutes. Wow. And I've actually got some photos here, and maybe we can dim the lights, it'll help you see them a little bit better. These were taken in Europe. So that's one showing the eclipse. Over a few trees, and then here's another shot. But my favorite one is this one here. This is high resolution, and you can actually see stars in the background. So if it was really dark, you could actually see all the stars. I think you can see one of the stars. Let's see. Yeah, there's one right there that you can see, one a little closer, one down here, and a couple over there, bright one over there. And in the old days, before we had space technology, it was these lunar eclipses where they were able to see background stars, and we would look for our stars that would be passed over by the moving moon. The moon moves across the sky by about 13 degrees a day, and as it does, it passes over stars. And there's those occasions where you get what's called a grazing occultation, where the moon is moving in such a way that a star is passing in and out of the mountains on the edge. And when I was a child, back in the Dark Ages, when the dinosaurs roamed the Earth, that's how we astronomers were able to measure the geological and geographical features of the moon. We did it through these grazing occultations, because that would show you the valleys and the mountains on the edge of the moon's surface. So, but the reason why, we can turn the lights back on, the reason why I got so many interviews about this is because there were three very famous Bible prophecy preachers on TV and radio that were saying, this is a sign of the end. And I loved one of them. He said, And what was generating it is that this is 2018. And 2018 minus 1948 is 70 years. And they were alluding to the fact that you see some references that the generation that sees the flourishing of the fig tree will not pass until the Lord returns. And a lot of people think that text is referring to the second rebirth of Israel. And they're saying a generation, one definition is 70 years, this has got to be it, this is the time of the end. And I love what one of these Bible prophecy preachers said, this is a sign of the end, something is about to happen. And I said, you know what, I think he's right, something is about to happen. That's a prediction that I think is going to come true. And in fact, he actually had me participate in a film that he was doing where he's making this point that something dramatic is going to happen in the nation of Israel. And my comment is, well, something dramatic happens in the nation of Israel every month. So I think that prophecy will be fulfilled as well. So, however, I do want to compliment, I won't name who he is, but I do want to compliment him. He actually had me participate in this film as a critic of his model. And of all the ones that are promoting this idea, he was the only one that was actually willing to have an astronomer come in and actually offer a critical response. So, but the response I gave is, he's basically quoting out of Joel chapter 2, that there will come a time when the moon will turn red like the blood of a corpse, and that will be a sign of the end. But that's only quoting a piece of the passage. If you actually look at the entirety of Joel chapter 2, it not only talks about the moon turning red and like the blood of a corpse, but the sun and the stars as well. And what happened on Friday, only the moon turned red. The sun and stars didn't turn red. Only the moon did. And the other thing that concerns me is a lot of these Bible prophecy people basically are trying to make the point that this is a really rare event. Well, you get a lunar eclipse twice a year. And twice a year, about half the world's population or more get to see it. This is not a rare event. And then they talk about, what if you get a set of four? Well, they call that a tetrad, where you get four consecutive, what they call blood moons. You get eight per century. So they're not all that rare either. They're common events, and the text says it's not just the moon that will turn red, the sun and stars will as well. And that's also repeated in Revelation 8. And what's interesting about Revelation 8, it tells us it will happen at a time when a third of the world's forests and a third of the world's grasslands will burn up. Well, we live here in Southern California. What happens when you get a nearby forest fire? What happens to the color of the sun, moon, and stars when you get a forest fire? They turn red and they get dim, because that's what the text says in Revelation 8. The light of the sun, moon, and stars will be dim and it will turn red. And Joel chapter 2 makes the same statement. And so it's interesting that Revelation 8 says this will happen at the same time a third of the world's forests and grasslands will burn up. Now, we've got forest fires here, but it's not one third of the total planet, just a few forest fires here and there. But yeah, those of us that live here in Southern California, we get to see that phenomena on a fairly frequent basis. But yeah, when I was interviewed for that film, I realized I was talking to Bible prophecy experts who had never really had the experience of seeing what happens in a forest fire. I said, oh, really? It actually happens? And I said, well, you're an astronomer. Explain to us why it happens. I says, it's easy. We astronomers see the continuum of stars and galaxies turn red, and the farther away they look, the redder they look. So it's not just something you see with the moon. The reason why is there's dust in the universe. And dust is the property that it reddens light that passes through it. When you get a forest fire, you get a lot of dust in the atmosphere. And all that dust will redden that light. So anyway, that's enough said. If you really want to hear my response to this, Eric Metaxas on his show interviewed me about this, and I posted a link on my Facebook and Twitter pages to that interview. And actually, what was exciting is I told Eric, look, I'm really excited about this lunar eclipse because I think a lot of people will see it. And what's amazing is we live in the 21st century when I think it's probably a majority of humanity has never bothered to look up and look at this thing. It's beautiful. But it says, you know, thousands of years ago, this was routine. Everybody saw these things. Today, we're so busy, we never bother to look up and see it. So I'm hoping that people actually pay attention to this and really pay attention to just how amazing the moon is. It's unique. If you look at the moons of Jupiter, they're small compared to their planet. That's true of all the moons in the solar system except our moon. Our moon is the exception. It's 50 times bigger than any other moon when it's compared to the mass of its host planet. And because we're orbited, we're a small planet orbited by a single gigantic moon, our rotation axis only tilts over by plus or minus 2 degrees, as I discussed last week when we were talking about those exoplanets. And so what I've done is actually created a special part on our website. You go to reasons.org/moon, it pops up for you 11 articles that I've written on how amazingly designed the moon is to make possible humans and human civilization. And most people have no idea. In fact, 20 different features of the moon must be fine-tuned to make our existence here on Earth possible. So hey, if you know anybody that's been talking about the moon, feel free to send them to reasons.org/moon, and hopefully they'll realize, hey, there's a lot more to the moon than I ever thought about, and what we know about the moon really testifies there's a God that must have designed it. Okay, that's enough about the moon. I really want to get on to our study in the book of Isaiah. So let me see if I can exit this. Come on, this is supposed to work. What's wrong here? This is a brand new computer. I mean,
it's a little pinched. Are we getting to Isaiah actually now?
Yeah, that's where I'm trying to switch to. I'm trying to switch all my slides on Isaiah. So the lunar eclipse is blocking my pathway to Isaiah. So, no? Well, I know a brute force way. Oh, here we go. It just needed a couple of seconds. Okay, and what happened? Oh, here's my Isaiah stuff. Here we go. All right. Now, I was in such a rush to try to get to the church this morning, I forgot to bring all my copies of our study questions on Isaiah, plus all the scripture passages we've been going through and what Isaiah says about the universe and how God designs the universe for our benefit. I've handed out hundreds of them in this class, so hopefully you've got them with you.
There's some here,
actually. Okay, so if you don't have them, they're over there on top of the piano. Feel free to get up and take one. But I've actually got them all here on my computer. But I'm going to jump right in Isaiah 45. And my goal is that we'll be able to get through all the scripture passages we've had here in Isaiah. We weren't part of the discussion where we went through the first 45 chapters of Isaiah and what it says about God creating and designing the universe. You can actually get the previous week's messages. They're all archived at paradoxes.org. So you can download them either in audio form or a video form. But this is where we left off last week. Isaiah 45:18. God is the creator of the heavens. He formed the earth and made it. He established it. He did not create it to be empty, but formed it to be inhabited. I'm Yahweh, and there is no other. Now, I'm just going to summarize for you what we discussed last week. When we get into Isaiah 45:21, I want you to jump in and participate about how this particular text helps us answer questions 1 and 2 on our study of Isaiah. Incidentally, question 3 is all going to be about the Trinity. As I mentioned before in the class, know the book of the Bible gives us more content on the doctrine of the Trinity than the book of Isaiah. And this is particularly helpful when you're engaging Jews, and engaging Muslims, because they do pay attention to the book of Isaiah, but most of them really haven't actually looked and pieced together all these texts that speak about God being a triune being. So that's where we're going to get to go when I'm back here in the class. But this basic text is saying that God carefully designed the universe. He designed the earth. He designed the earth in such a way that it can be packed with a superabundance of diverse life. That's something we astronomers are really beginning to appreciate. When we look at other planets, we realize no other planet can possibly take the load of diverse living creatures than what we have here on planet Earth. The other thing we're discovering is that this text has been true throughout the entire history of life on planet Earth. 3.825 billion years ago is when the Earth first became cool enough that it was possible to have life, but since that time, Earth has always had the maximum abundance and maximum diversity of life forms that the laws of physics that God chose could possibly tolerate. He created it. He did not create it to be empty, but formed it to be inhabited. He formed it to be maximally inhabited. And no matter where you go on our planet, you see life. I mean, you can go to Antarctica and find life. There's actually bacteria there that are able to withstand temperatures far below freezing. And that's because in Antarctica, they got these lakes below the ice that are salty, sufficiently salty that they stay liquid even at, say, 15, 17 degrees Fahrenheit. And so wherever you got the possibility of life existing, life exists there. They've actually found life 10,000 feet below the surface of the Earth. These little microbes that go down through the cracks of the Earth and actually get all the way down there. And they feed on the escaping methane that exists at that level. They've actually found life 20 miles up in the atmosphere. There are diatoms that float up there. No matter where you go, there's life. Matter of fact, I just answered a question on my Facebook page making the point. Somebody asked me, is it possible that there's life in the upper atmosphere of Venus? Interesting question. The most Earth-like place outside of planet Earth in our solar system is the upper atmosphere of Venus. If you go to a certain height above the surface of Venus, the temperature and the pressure are identical to what we have here on the surface of planet Earth. Same air pressure and same temperature. And so people speculate, well, maybe life could survive there. So people ask me, do you think there's life there? And I said, I really do think there's life there. It's life that's come from planet Earth. I mean, look at this text, how God has packed the Earth to be inhabited. He's packed it so full of life that Earth life actually has escaped the gravity of our planet and has literally littered the entire solar system. So in the upper atmosphere of Venus, there will be the remains of these Earth microbes. They won't be viable. They'll be the remains of Earth microbes because they travel from planet Earth to Venus. You've got to go through unprotected space. So it's going to be irradiated. It's going to take a long time to get there. And so we're looking, but they will find the remains of Earth life in the upper atmosphere of Venus. And incidentally, you may have heard this, there was what was called a shocking breakthrough discovery of Mars this past week. I actually got to do a few interviews on that as well. In fact, I actually wound up writing a blog on it. They found this lake on Mars. In fact, what one internet article said, we found a giant liquid water lake on Mars. Well, that's why I wrote an article on what the peer-reviewed article actually says. Now, it is big. We're talking 12 and a half miles across. And it was announced as, I mean, what was interesting is one person who was interviewing me said, can we take a motorboat on this lake? I says, no, it's 1.5 kilometers below the surface of Mars. And if you read the paper, they say, we found probable liquid water. They're not even sure it's definitive. And I think they're right. I do agree that it's likely they found liquid water, But the researchers are clear in saying we don't see this as definitive evidence. It's just strong evidence that there's liquid water there. And they were not able to measure the thickness of the water. Now, the lead researcher said, we're talking more than just a very thin film, but it could be just a couple of millimeters. So yeah, I wouldn't get your powerboat on that thing. It's, yes?
What gas would the powerboat run on?
Good question. Where are you going to get the gasoline? So.
Well, not only the gasoline, but the oxygen.
And the oxygen, too, yeah. There's not enough oxygen to make them work. Maybe battery powered, I don't know. So, but here's the other thing is that they found it at the South Pole of Mars. And actually, that's about the only place you're going to find liquid water, because the pressure of the ice above this little patch that they found, it's sufficient to raise the temperature to minus 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, the brightness, they basically found it with radar. The radar reflected off the water, and they said it's too bright to be ice, it's too bright to be rock. And again, they said maybe it's too bright to be ice or rock, and it's the brightness that would match liquid water. But yeah, if it is water, it's at minus 90. And that really was about half the research paper. How could water be liquid at minus 90 degrees? Because that's the warmest it could possibly be, is minus 90 degrees. And basically they pointed out, there's been experiments done in physics labs where they've taken liquid water, super saturated it with perchlorate salts, and stays liquid. And you say, well, how much colder can you get it? Well, the limit's about minus 92. At minus 92, even the perchlorates will not keep it liquid. Okay, which is why the researchers said, this is not a site for life. Perchlorate salt supersaturated at minus 90 degrees, nothing can live under those conditions. It basically is way too cold and way too salty for any conceivable life form to be able to exist there. So, and that's very different than what the popular internet articles have been saying. And what I wrote in my blog article is that basically it's a theme I've been trying to communicate to people who read my blog, is that when you read the internet stories, always look for the peer-reviewed paper on which it is based, and always at least read the abstract of the paper. And here's the good news. The abstract is always free to the public. Anybody, and usually the abstract's written in such a way that if you don't have a PhD in a discipline, you can still understand the bottom line. Yeah.
Hugh, is there an online news source that you're aware of that's actually reliable when it comes to science stories?
Yeah, reasons.org. No, some are better than others. So, but. Yeah, even the ones that I tend to like Science Daily and Space.com, they tend to be a little sensationalistic. And so, but typically what they do is actually give you a link. You know, I would say this, any internet science news outlet designed to communicate to the general public, trust the ones where they actually give you a link to the research paper. Because when they do that, they know you're probably going to hit that link and check up on it. So, and I always tell people, even when you read an article like that where they give you the link, please check the link. You know, actually make sure that, and you really want to look to see whether the tone of the article matches the tone of what the people are saying in their peer review paper. So, yes?
There's a lot of biblical references that say that God created the earth and the life. Is there any place where it states categorically, and there's no life nowhere else?
Nope. If you're a Christian and a student of the Bible, you've got options on what you can believe about extraterrestrial life. And incidentally, that goes all the way back to the 5th century AD. And particularly during the Middle Ages, the 1100s and the 1200s, there was quite a few. I mean, Aquinas, for example, talks about how, I mean, based on what we see in the Bible, it could well be that God has created life elsewhere. as based on the fact that when we look at planet Earth, and particularly this text we're looking at here, where it tells us that God did not create our planet to be empty, but to be full, to be completely inhabited and packed with life, that at least suggests the possibility maybe God really likes creating life. And if he really likes creating life, why is he going to stop on one planet? And therefore, back in the Middle Ages, theologians said, we really do think it's likely that God has created life elsewhere. And I've run into Christians who are research scientists who say, we think this would be terrific, because we already know that the only way you get life here on planet Earth is through a divine intervention miracle. If we find life on another planet, that means we've got more evidence for divine miraculous interventions, not less. And so he was arguing, I think God will have done this many times. That's one side of the theological debate. The other side of the Christian theological debate is, when you read the Gospels, we notice that when Jesus was performing miracles, there were times when he refused to perform miracles. And basically he said, all you want from me is the physical stuff. And I perform these miracles to make a spiritual point. And so you can easily read the Gospels and conclude that God conserves his miracles. And what I mean by that is the theological idea, God performs as few miracles as possible to achieve his ultimate goals and ends. So it raises the issue, how many planets in the universe does God need to create life on in order to achieve his redemptive purpose? And those theologians said, on that basis, we think Earth is alone. God only needs to do it once. But then there are others who say, well, maybe God's redemptive purpose includes more than just the human species. And then so people speculate. But here's what's interesting. From a Christian perspective, you've got options on this question of extraterrestrial life. It's perfectly okay to say planet Earth is alone. It's also okay to say he's done it many other places. It's also okay to say, well, maybe he limited it on other planets, but he went full bore here on planet Earth. That's the idea, that God maybe had created grass and dolphins and other planets, but not the equivalent of human beings. And so look at the multiple positions. And years ago, we're going back, 30 years ago, three astronomers, I was included amongst the three, we wrote an article on the different options that we have on extraterrestrial life. And each of us agreed to defend one of the three predominant positions. But we made it clear, look, we're not saying we believe this position, we're just volunteering to defend these positions and show that all three have biblical merit. But the reason we wrote the article was to make the point, from a non-theistic perspective, you've only got one option. From a non-theistic perspective, there has to be life elsewhere. Because you're basically arguing God did not miraculously intervene to create life. The appearance of life is something that naturally flows out of the physics and the chemistry. Therefore, it's a relatively easy step. It must be everywhere. And so this is an irony, because a number of atheist scientists accuse us Christians of being closed-minded on this issue, whereas they're broad-minded, but it's actually the opposite. They're narrow-minded, whereas we Christians have a variety of options. Now, where the three of us astronomers did agree, however, is that there is one biblical constraint, which is open to a little bit of interpretation. Hebrews 9 and 10 says, Jesus Christ, the creator of the universe, came to earth one time, one place, to redeem all. So that suggests that we humans are alone in the universe of being physical, intelligent, soulish, spiritual beings who are in need of redemption. We're in a fallen state. But again, that doesn't stop God making whales and dolphins on another planet. It simply restricts him. And there have been theologians who say, well, we're not sure you can be that closed-minded even on those passages. Maybe God has created another species that's in need of redemption. Maybe what Jesus did on the cross actually would accommodate that. But the text does say, one time, one place for all. So if it's for all, then we have to kind of interpret it that maybe they were watching the crucifixion, the resurrection, and some kind of high-tech television from another distant planet. But that's possible. Again, there are options. So, okay, yes. Well, that was what was pointed out. We do see microbes that are able to handle conditions below the normal freezing point of water and also very salty conditions, but not that cold and not that salty. And moreover, we can't even conceive of a biochemical metabolic pathway whereby a simple bacterium could survive at that extremely low temperature and with that degree of salt. Just making the biochemistry work seems utterly inconceivable.
So there was kind of a chemistry argument, perhaps?
Yeah, yeah, there's a biochemical argument saying that's just too cold and too salty, and perchlorates are nasty salts.
Agreed.
So, yeah, you don't want to be consuming perchlorates. So. Yeah.
There's an energy source.
That's an energy source, but too much of an energy source. So, yeah, if you want to get holes in your stomach, that's a quick way to do it. Okay, yes.
Romans 8:22 says we know that creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present. So does that change just to the earth, or would that be the universe?
I interpret that as being universe, because it says the entire creation is subject to this groaning. And that's a reference to the second law of thermodynamics. It's basically saying the entire universe is subject to a pervasive law of decay. Verse 23 says that will continue until the full number of humans that God intends to redeem have been redeemed. So there's actually a promise there in Romans 8. A time will come when we'll no longer have thermodynamics. But the whole universe has been subjected to thermodynamics. And Romans 8 is basically saying God designed the universe from the very beginning, ruled by the laws of thermodynamics, so that he could bring about the redemption of billions of human beings, which implies there's something about this pervasive law of decay that's critical for our redemption. And if you're interested in pursuing that, I got a whole book on that called Why the Universe is the Way It Is.
So that
why it is we need this thermodynamics.
So that would probably suggest that there are no Earth-like planets anywhere else.
Well, we are finding Earth-like planets. If you define Earth-like, same size and same relative distance from their host star. But we've yet to find one that's sufficiently Earth-like that it could be a candidate to support advanced life. So, I mean, NASA right now is very involved in trying to find what they call habitable planets. And that's why I mentioned last week, if you take into account the how extreme the Milankovitch cycles will be for these extrasolar planets, habitability now really begins to focus just on our planet Earth. I mean, NASA loves to talk about where there's liquid water, we got a possibility of finding life. And they're right. All life needs liquid water. You're not going to have life without liquid water. But as I mentioned here in the class, we live in a universe that's soaking wet. Water is the third most abundant molecule in the universe. So if that's your criteria, you're going to find lots of regions which would be, quote, habitable. But again, you can see it's an improbable planet. 9 different habitable zones that are required for life to possibly exist. And we know of a couple of planets that reside in 2. I think one resides in 3 of those habitable zones. Only one planet resides in all 9 habitable zones simultaneously. And that's the planet that we're all sitting on right now. Yes.
Planet is Earth.
I think you got that one right. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but that's what that means. In my father's house, there are many mansions. I thought about that for years, and I don't understand what it means. Does it mean that it's...
Well, I mean, that's chapter 14 in John, where Jesus says, I'm going away. And he's basically referring to his crucifixion and resurrection. He says, I'm going to prepare a place for you where there's going to be many mansions. He's basically making it, we're not talking this planet. We're talking somewhere else where he's going to be making a future home for us. And Revelation 20 is not Mars. Well, according to the passage we just pulled up here, Romans chapter 8, it's going to be in a realm where there's no thermodynamics. And also, if you read Revelation 21, there's no gravity there. There's no electromagnetism there. And why the universe is the way it is, I explain why you need those laws of physics to restrain evil and to encourage people to seek a path towards virtue. Those laws are there to guide us in that direction. And the reason those laws don't exist in new creation, there's no sin there, there's no evil there. And so yeah, we don't get the mansions until the evil and sin have been eradicated by our Creator. But the very universe was designed with the laws of physics to bring about the permanent eradication of sin and evil. And this is what I think is unique about Christianity. Christianity teaches that God began his works of redemption before he created anything at all. So everything in creation, everything in the universe, is for the purpose of bringing about the redemption of us human beings from the grip of sin and evil. And so once that has been achieved, no longer is there any need for thermodynamics. No longer any of us experience decay. I mean, in the new creation, your bodies will not decay. So, yay, right? Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. Whenever you talk about is there life elsewhere out there, we're talking about the silo that we see of time and space, but God doesn't have time and space. Infinity is infinity. And we can't even get to there. I mean, you don't even know where the end of the universe is as we know it. And we don't know where the end of time is as we know it. So there could have been life 8 to the, you know, 0000000 zero power that we can't even comprehend.
The
right?
Bible actually tells us that God created life that exists beyond our universe. They're called angels, okay? And the Bible is silent on whether or not God created more than angels outside of our universe. In fact, there are hints that you see in Revelation 21 and 22 that we get into the new creation, redeemed humans will be there, the righteous angels will be there, but also talks about kingdoms, whatever that means. So there could be something else. But when we talk about extraterrestrial life, at least when we scientists talk about extraterrestrial life, we're talking about within the physical universe.
That we see.
Yeah, and so far, everywhere we look in the universe, we see conditions that are hostile for life, except here on planet Earth, with the important caveat, again, based on this text. Boy, it's taken us a long time to get to this text. Based on 45:18, life is so abundant and diverse on planet Earth, our planet literally has infected the entire solar system. So there's so much life on planet Earth that significant fractions of that life have made it to the moon, made it to Mars, made it to Venus, the moons of Jupiter. You know, when I speak at the NASA facilities, I let them know, your search for life on Mars is guaranteed to be successful, simply because of all the life that's been transported from Earth to Mars. If you look hard enough, you will find the remains of that transported Earth life. And what transports that Earth life are the occasional bombardments of our planet by big meteoroids. If you get a big enough meteoroid, and by the way, all you need is something that's 100 to 150 feet across or bigger, when that hits the Earth, it hits it with enough force that it exports microbes away from the gravity of the Earth and distributes it throughout the solar system. Now, we're not talking a lot. If you're talking Mars, you're looking at 200 kilograms for every 100 square kilometers.
But that's so, life can survive
I'm saying the remains of life. I mean, actually, some of my colleagues have argued that there is a very minuscule probability that some of the hardiest of Earth's microbes could actually get to Mars and still be viable. But it's an extremely tiny probability of that happening. Much more likely, they're going to be killed in the pathway from Earth to Mars. But you should be able to find those remains on Mars. And
you say there's a lot on the moon, right, already?
Well, there's 100 times as much on the moon.
Yeah.
So we go to the moon, it's going to be relatively easy to find the remains of Earth life on the moon. Matter of fact, we actually have a high probability we'll find undisturbed fossils of Earth's first life on the moon. Because unlike Mars and Venus, the moon has had much less geological activity. So a much lower probability that the Earth-transported life will be damaged. And it's a shorter trip. They can get there a lot faster. So, in fact, I got to speak at NASA Houston saying, I think that needs to be a NASA mission, to go back to the moon and get some of that Earth-transported soil and analyze that for the fossils of Earth's first life. Because we'll never find the fossils of Earth's first life on Earth. Earth's geology has destroyed them. But interesting, there was a paper written by three astronomers I know, and it was titled Rummaging Through Earth's Attic. And the attic they're referring to is the moon, and saying just like we store stuff in our attics, there's a lot of Earth life that's been stored in the attic of planet Earth, namely the moon. And basically made the argument, we actually know that the greatest quantity of those microbes were transported when we're looking very early in the history of Earth's life. And so they're saying, we need to rummage through the attic, find the fossils of Earth's first life. And one of the three astronomers was a Christian. I know him well, and his comment is, we can actually look at those microbes and the fossils of those microbes and determine who got it right. Did the theist get it right on the origin of life, or did the atheist get it right on the origin of life? And I had the pleasure of speaking at NASA Houston saying, you know what, this is a project that NASA could undertake that will be exciting for theists and exciting for non-theists. And the last time I checked, that made up 100% of the U.S. taxpayer base. So this could be a great way for NASA to get a lot of public encouragement and the funding. But they want to go to Mars instead, which is 100 times harder to find there. Okay, let's move on to Isaiah 45:21. Who predicted this long ago? Who announced it from ancient times? Was it not I, Yahweh? There is no other God but me, a righteous God and Savior. There's no one except me. Incidentally, this will be one of the passages we'll be studying on the Trinity. Because notice it's making the point, God is one and only one. But what we're also going to discover is the book of Isaiah talks about three independent persons that are part of this one God. But it's basically making the point, as other texts in Isaiah have made, that God and only God can create. Satan, as powerful as he is not in that category of being able to create. This is something God alone does. No one except me can do this. And, you know, there are people today saying, we're on the verge of creating life in the lab, so we can do what God can do. This text is saying, no one except me can pull this off. And I've got colleagues that think that one day we will actually be able to make a bacterium in the lab. So far, all I've been able to do is take one bacterium, change a bit of the biochemistry, and still get it to live. So they're re-engineering bacteria. They're not creating it from scratch. And when they talk about, hey, we're on the verge of making life in the lab, what they mean is we're going to take the building blocks that have already been produced by life and reassemble them. And maybe that's possible, but there's an interesting debate going on. You know, why don't we take a simple bacterium and we're going to knock out a gene here or there or a particular piece of RNA and DNA and actually have the thing stop living. then put it back and see if we can bring it back to life. Now that's a pretty simple step. Just take one critical piece of molecular machinery out of the cell, which basically forces it to die, and put it back in and see if you can bring it back to life. That's a whole lot easier than trying to build life from scratch, right? Well, no one's ever been able to pull that off. And there's a big debate going on. Is it even conceivable that we could actually kill a bacterium in the simplest way possible and bring it back to life? Yes?
About those worms that I read about this week that were frozen for 30,000 years and they thawed them out and they moved around and started eating?
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's bacteria that are like that too.
Does the freezing them kill them?
It puts them into storage. And so, yeah, there's many life forms that basically have very sophisticated hibernation properties. And so, for example, there's a bacterium that's able to withstand a total lack of water for 3 years and come back to life. It basically goes into suspended animation. There's also ones that can handle severe temperature changes. And there's even one bacterium that can handle rather hard radiation up to a year. And take the radiation away, it can come back to life. But it's basically the equivalent of going into a hyper-hibernated state. And so this worm, or this bacterium, basically shuts down a lot of these life processes, but it's got a mechanism to start up. It's still alive, it's just in hibernation. What we're talking about is experiments. What if we actually kill an organism? Can we bring it back? Can we resurrect a bacterium? And I've got a number of colleagues who are really interested in that, saying it's possible that in terms of looking at life, we're missing something that's critical for life. We think it's just biochemical machinery. Maybe if there's more to it than that. And it's kind of like the analogy. You can have a car sitting in the garage. All the machinery is there, but it doesn't do anything until you get behind the wheel and turn on the ignition. Then it can do something. And so is it possible that there's an ignition switch in the biochemistry of these simple microorganisms that we really don't understand? And so basically those of us with reasons to believe are saying, you know, rather than trying to make life from scratch, let's start with a much easier program first. We might learn something that'll actually illuminate what is possible for we humans. And maybe this has an impact in how we interpret this text. So, yes.
It seems like the taking a part out would be futile in that life, I thought, is always a dynamic, continuous equilibrium. And we have several parts working together and not just one.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's the issue. I mean, is there anything you can take out that truly kills the organism and get it back to work? I mean, you can do that with an automobile.
Yes, it would kill it because there are other things that depend upon that one thing.
Right.
But to come back to life is impossible because there's a dynamic equilibrium between several things that have to continue for life to continue.
Well, that would be very good to explore. I mean, there are people who are saying, maybe we can get around that. Can we really get around that? And, you know, one of our biochemists is making a point. We think non-theistic biochemists have overlooked a lot of the complexity of life. I mean, basically raising those points. If you've got interconnected parts, knocking out one part actually knocks out a whole cascade of parts. Well, okay, can we find something simple enough where we're only knocking out, say, six parts by taking one part out and be able to bring that back? I mean, what can we do? But our whole argument is, that's actually an easier biochemical step than trying to take, say, a bunch of amino acids, sugars, and nucleic bases and trying to make life from scratch. Let's just see if there's something fundamental about viability of these things we call microorganisms that we're overlooking.
You know, the scientists I enjoy the most, since we're connecting to this, to first life, are those who say, we just don't have the knowledge or the expertise to talk about first life well.
True, but then you got people like those that work at Craig Venter's lab who say, we got it all figured out, okay? And they're actually doing these kinds of experiments. But the one set of experiments they haven't done is, okay, what can we do to, in a very limited way stop the viability of an organism and bring it back to life. But yeah, there are people at Craig Venter's lab that think all the barriers to making life from scratch have been removed. Well, let's prove it.
Yeah. Just a lot of them are not like.
Oh yeah. No, this is a debate that's going on.
So in the hubris, though, zombies might actually be possible to some degree.
Well, I'm not going to go there. Okay.
No, I said a zombie.
Okay.
Possible.
Yes.
When it says ancient times, can we interpret that as billions and billions of years, and that the universe itself shows that God exists?
Well, that's been a debate that we've been having with our young Earth friends. I mean, what does the Old Testament mean when it uses this word ancient? Are we talking billions, thousands, whatever? And this is something I discuss in my book, Always a Matter of Days, is that when a text uses the word ancient, it's saying older than what you can imagine. So even in the context of people lived 3,000, 4,000 years ago, the use of the word ancient communicated something more than just thousands of years, because it's well within our capability of imagining. And there's also texts in the Bible that refer to the ancient river, the ancient mountains, the ancient fields, as an analogy for God's eternal existence. Basically saying to the Jews at that time, you see that mountain there? As ancient as you think that mountain is, I've been around a whole lot longer than that mountain. You know, I'm the eternal one. So the fact that it uses rivers and erosion and mountains as analogies for God's eternal existence, again, we communicate we're talking more than just a few thousand years. And incidentally, I've argued in a matter of days, people living 3,000 years ago were not as ignorant of science as we think. So, you know, when David was in the wilderness and he was talking about how ancient the mountains of the wilderness were, you know, some of us have been to those mountains. They're basically by the Dead Sea. And if you go to those mountains, you see piles of gravel at the bottom of the mountains. And I can imagine King David there was writing this song, and what he notices, once every 2 days, a small pebble falls off the mountain. And look at the size of the pile of pebbles at the bottom. And you know, he knew enough arithmetic to realize if I multiply that all out, that's a long, long time. So the ancients, well, we're well aware of the processes of erosion. It's not just those of us living in the 21st century. And I mentioned here in the class too, we astronomers are still using the astronomical measurements of the Egyptians recorded 3,000, 3,500 years ago to fine-tune our models of the interior physics of stars. Because of the fact that these astronomers living in Egypt at that time were so diligent in trying to understand the universe above them. They knew the diameter of the Earth to 1% precision. So they had already refuted the flat Earth hypothesis 3,500 years ago. And actually made sophisticated measurements in the diameter of the Earth. They knew that the Sun was a whole lot bigger. They knew the distance. They knew that the planets orbited around the Sun. Wasn't the Sun going around the Earth? The reason why you get this story that these Egyptian astronomers were geocentrists, it's the only way, given the mathematics they had at that time, to predict the future positions of planets, was to do the math as if the Earth was the center. And once the math became available where they weren't restricted anymore, they immediately went back. But yeah, they already understood that the Sun had to be the center. They knew the stars were suns. They were so far away that they had to be bodies just like the Sun. They knew a lot. Yeah. And you know, King David out there in the wilderness, he knew all about geology. So let's not demean their level of science. Okay. No other God but me. And Isaiah 46, 9 to 10, remember what happened long ago, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and no one is like me. I declare the end from the beginning and from long ago what is not yet done, saying my plan will take place and I will do all my will. Okay, we've not discussed this passage at all before, so I want some feedback from you. What is this text telling us about the universe and God's creation activity in designing the universe? And what is he saying about recorded scripture here? Says there'll be an end. Yep. Says there was a beginning.
In this universe.
Yeah. Okay.
Things are not yet done.
It's also making the point, I'm doing it all by myself. There is no other. Keeps, notice how frequently the book of Isaiah repeats that. I did it all by myself. No one else helped me. The angels weren't involved. So this is something I did on my own, for my own purpose. Okay, what else do you get out of this text?
That seems to be important, yeah, for us to know, yeah.
Well, what you notice during the epistles in the New Testament, you got Paul and the author of the book of Hebrews having to refute this idea that the angels participated with God in creation. And incidentally, this persists to this day in Judaism. The Jews, for example, in their interpretation of Genesis 1, make note of the fact, they insist, Genesis 1 does not teach the doctrine of the Trinity. When it talks about we creating, and when it speaks about humanity, it says that's the royal we, where God's including the angels. They actually have the angels involved as a part of that. And this text is saying, no, the angels are creative beings just like us. God does it. He does it all by himself. But there's another point I'm trying to drag out of you from this text here. What is this saying about God's power? Yeah, go ahead.
God is usually derived from the word Elohim. Elohim is the plural name of God.
Yeah. That's in Genesis 1. He uses the word Elohim. And what's interesting about that word, it means the one who is uniplural. The one who is singular and plural at the same time. And when you get to God creating human beings, it uses singular pronouns and plural pronouns for the same event. So that's kind of the doctrine of Trinity. One God, but multiple persons are involved in that one God.
So it's a mystery that would not be revealed until the New Testament came along.
Yeah, but notice this text here in the Old Testament is saying God did it all by himself. There were no others involved. So when you're talking about we, it's God that's part of the we. The angels are not part of the we. Okay, no one is like me. I declare the end from the beginning and from long ago what is not yet done, saying my plan will take place and I'll do all my will. What is this saying about God's control of creation? Yes?
He's got a plan.
He's got a plan. He's going to carry it out. Nothing's going to disturb it. I saw a hand over here.
Would that plan be referring to his redemptive plan that he has for the creation of the universe?
I think it refers to his reason why he created in the first place, was to fulfill his redemptive plan. But I think he's also referring to every component of creation. It's all worked out. I'm in control of it. He's also making the claim here that he's got predictive power. I know the future. I control the past. And this is something that we see in the Bible itself. Notice when the Bible speaks about creation, it predicts things that were not known to the people at the time it was recorded. And God is saying, yeah, I can do this. And this is one of my, yeah, go ahead, Steve.
Do you think when it says, and from long ago what is not yet done, that there are things today that are not yet done that we can look at as predictors, but even they inform science and intelligence?
No, I would totally agree with that. I mean, I communicate with my peers all the time who are not believers and saying, if you study the Bible, it will guide you in your scientific research and make you more efficient in your scientific research.
Can you name one or two?
Well, okay. Probably one of the more dramatic examples of that was 40, 50 years ago, the scientific community was giving up on looking for purpose in the genome, because it said, when we look at the human genome, less than 2% of the genetic data for the human genome has any benefit for coding for proteins. And basically they gave up for looking at any other purposes. Whereas from a biblical perspective, it's like everything's got a purpose. Everything's been designed. And it was actually a group of physicists who jumped in and said, you know, the biologists aren't looking at this, we're going to look at it. And basically said, we see more evidence for design in the non-coding part of the genome than we do the coding part. And that led to a revolution where they said, okay, maybe there's more to this than just coding for the construction of the proteins.
Is that junk DNA?
Well, that was the term for the 98%, that it was useless junk that accumulated through natural evolution. But even what the physicists point out when they first worked on this, they said, wait a minute, we human beings haven't been around that long. And you're saying there's all this accumulated junk? And, you know, we have this really big genome, and we happen to take the longest in terms of our development. It takes 25 years for a young man to become an adult. You probably all noticed that, not just physically. And maybe there's functionality that is involved in our development process. And maybe that's why maybe the human genome looks so much junkier than the genomes of simpler life forms. And so that's when they began to look.
They don't use that term anymore, do they, that junk DNA?
Oh, they still do. Yeah, they're now saying, well, it's not 98% junk, it's 20% junk. Okay, because then now we know that 80% of the human genome has function. But what's interesting, it has function in places that nobody bothered to look.
And it shows you how wrong we can be, right?
Well, Buzz Rana, my colleague, has been writing saying, we actually have evidence that 20% is shrinking. And it's basically the 20% where we haven't looked yet. And we begin to look, he says it's now down to about 10% that they're calling junk. But again, it's the 10% where we haven't looked yet. And so his prediction is it's going to drop down to less than 1%. And, you know, something at that level,
That's good. You
can explain as just the thermodynamics of the fact that we've been around for 50,000 years. Okay, I saw a hand over here. Okay, no? Yes.
So what the scripture is saying to me is that God has a plan and has a will. And that everything is happening according to his plan. So he knew before the creation of the universe who we were going to be and what we were going to do. And it just shows that God knows happening.
Yeah, and just to follow up on Steve's point here, I mean, in terms of testing a Christian worldview versus an atheistic worldview, atheistic science has been driven by the fact that when we look at the creation, most of it has no function, purpose, it's superfluous, it's just wasted. Whereas a Christian perspective is no, none of it is wasted. And therefore, we need to guide our research and actually look for purpose when we think is waste. Just like, you know, 60 years ago, they thought the appendix was a useless organ holdover from naturalistic evolution. Because they thought that if it had a purpose, it must have a purpose in digestion. And so there's no purpose at all in digestion. But we now know it serves an important purpose in the immune response system. So notice, when I was a child, if you had anything in surgery in your abdomen, they always took out your appendix. Let's get rid of this useless thing. They don't do that anymore. So if you have abdominal surgery, they leave your appendix alone, unless it's at the point of, you know, bursting and causing you problems. So, and we now have the perspective, yes?
You got about 2 minutes before I got to interrupt you.
Okay, 2 minutes. Let's see if we can at least finish off this text. Okay, every event through the entirety of the universe, past, present, and future, is under God's control. It all has a purpose. None of it is wasted. 13.8 billion years, yet every part of it has an importance. Incidentally, I can't prove that 100%, but what I can share with you is whenever we've actually diligently looked for that purpose, we find it. We haven't finished the search yet. And I think that's what really needs to drive scientific research from a Christian perspective. Realize it all has value and purpose, and let's use that to guide our research. And, you know, God has it all under control. He knows the future. He's actually declared a lot of what that future will be in the pages of Scripture. The book of Isaiah is filled with both predictive history and predictive science. And here we go with Isaiah 48, and I'm going to close right here. Listen to me, Jacob and Israel, the one called by me. I am he, I am the first, I'm also the last. My own hand founded the earth. My right hand spread out the heavens. When I summoned them, they stood together. Okay, what has this got to say about astronomical research? What has this got to say about our quest to find a whole bunch of Earth-like planets? And what does this say about God and his characteristics? These passages in Isaiah are basically helping us understand the attributes of God, making the point you see in Romans 1. The heavens declare the glory of God. They not only declare God's existence, they declare his specific attributes. Look at the heavens. You're going to be able to figure that out. I'll turn it back over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Hugh. We have some important class business.
Oh, by the way, next week I hope to get... Oh, I won't be here
next
week.
You won't be here next week.
Yeah, I'm going to be speaking in North Carolina.
We'll try to listen, but I don't think we'll be able to.
No. However, we live stream this class, so I'll be able to listen.
That's right.
So that'll be great.
Yeah.
And a week after that, I'm going to be in a remote part of British Columbia.
Good.
So
we will be praying for you. It's good for you to tell us where you're going to be so we can pray.
Well, hopefully I'll bring back some exciting photos.
Good. Please stay up here.
Okay.
I'm sorry, with your birthday, we just messed it all up. And all we had for you was a cake. I'm just kidding.
Wow. Well, thank you for all these cards. Yes. Appreciate it.
Okay. We want to, on behalf of the class, again, I just want to say thank you for all the love and commitment and time and energy you put in to each one of us. And we're very grateful that you're here. And happy birthday.
Well, thank you. I could say something in return. I really value this class that I've been teaching for the past 43 plus years, because this is where I do experiments. In fact, some of the teaching I did here today is basically an experiment to see how it's going to work. And so I use all of you as guinea pigs for developing messages I take elsewhere. And I really appreciate the feedback you give me. I mean, you know, you guys are not afraid to tell me, you know, Hugh, I think this really doesn't hold as much water as you think. Or you know what? I think you've really lowballed this one. This has got a lot more potential. So I appreciate the feedback and appreciate the questions you ask. You know, a lot of audiences I address, they're afraid to put their hand up, but you're not afraid to put your hand up. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Two of my two favorite people in the world, well, I better say my wife first. And Jesus, you know, are in this room. And it's you and the one who led me to the Lord here, Jesse Burrell, open air preacher. And Dr. Ross, you had mentioned how open air preachers affected you. So we came late. I just wanted everybody to be sure to greet Brother Jesse Burrell here, openairoutreach.com. You know, we preached to like maybe 3,000-4,000 people yesterday at Huntington Beach Pier, right after Ray Comfort.
Well, I got a book coming out in September where I tell a story of being about a 10-year-old boy, and I heard 15 seconds of message from a street preacher. My parents yanked me away, get away from that nut. I didn't forget those 15 seconds. And it began me to start thinking. So, yeah.
He heard an open-air preacher. He was in prison. In his jail cell, he heard it from the outside, and he got saved in prison, in jail cell, from an open air preacher.
God's word does not return void.
It doesn't work, it works.
Right, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, everybody.
Microphone, you.
Microphone.